Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, April 27th, 2008, and this is show number 148. Well, you know, it's like 148 degrees in LA today. I don't know what happened. It's like a furnace out there. So I kept the house closed most of the day to try to keep it cool inside. And then I thought, okay, the afternoon breeze would come in. So I've got the windows open, so if you hear some birds chirping, just consider it the bird episode. I don't know what to do about it, but it's too hot without them open. So anyway, how'd you like getting that bonus episode this week? Kind of like a little surprise present in your feeds, huh? Sure glad I did it. It takes the pressure off of this show. I had so much good stuff stacked up, and I didn't want to just keep pushing it off. Some of the stuff I've been pushing off is in this show, so I've got enough for two shows. I did get some good feedback already, so I'll keep it in mind if I ever get overloaded with material again and I have time to post two shows. Well, in the background scenes here, Connor and I have been discussing the idea of an enhanced podcast feed. This has come up a lot of times, and people say, hey, Allison, why don't you do an enhanced podcast? So what I usually say to them is, hey, I have a great idea. How about you go through every minute of the show, entering the URLs and images, and then you export the file as an AAC, upload it to iTunes to add the tags, upload the file to the server, and update the feed for me. Well, this usually scares people off. They scamper away and go, okay, never mind, MP3's fine. But something's wrong with Connor, because he wrote back right away and said, okay. Yikes. We've been having discussions now about how best to do this and how much work it would be on his part. He did a little test version of it, and he said it took about 2 hours for him to put it together. I'm sure he can streamline that over time, but that's a lot of time to donate to the show. So I'm not sure what's going to happen here, but we're thinking about it. And he's a really committed kind of guy, so if he says he's going to do it, I think he really will stick to it. I'm curious whether you guys really like enhanced podcasts. If you have a choice, do you pick those? And if you'd rather subscribe to that one rather than an MP3 feed. One thing I will always do is an MP3 feed because it's more inclusive. You know, all MP3 players can get to come to the party and you don't have to have iTunes and iPods to get to listen to the show. You know, having grown up in the small minority of the computing community, I always like to think about the little guy. So I want to make sure that I do it in a way that it's accessible to everybody. But anyway, let us know what you think about the idea of an enhanced podcast. Loyal listener Jerry, well, that's what he called himself. I did not make that up. Anyway, loyal listener Jerry wrote in with this lovely letter. Allison, I'm a longtime listener to your podcast, and I have to say I love the way you present your material and the little stories you tell intermixed with the techie stuff. Don't change a thing in the way you podcast. Well, now on to the real reason I'm writing you. I was browsing the Apple site, and I came across an iPhone web app that I think you would like. It's called Belfry SciCalc. It's a calculator that you can toggle between algebraic and reverse Polish notation. And I know you love RPN. This app is really cool looking that you need to check it out. It's from scicalc.belfry.com. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for the kind words. That's really, really nice. It sure is a good thing that people seem to like my little side stories in my life because I can't seem to get to stop telling them anyway. So glad you do like them. I do think I've gotten into a good rhythm now with the podcast. When I listen to the shows, even from a year ago, they seem to sound a little bit stilted to me. I'm finally relaxed after 3 years of doing this. You'd think I would have gotten onto that a little sooner, but oh well, a little bit late. But anyway, I checked out SciCalc from Belfry, and it's a wonderful program. I really like it. Finally, to have a reverse Polish notation calculator on my iPhone. I sure hope someone writes one with a new SDK, too. Hey, I just thought of something. I could do a web clip of SciCalc on the iPhone, and then it would be just like a real application. I'm really excited now. You remember a while back when I went on this rampage about how Apple pushed out a software update? Notice the air quotes around update to Safari on Windows, to people who didn't even have Safari installed? I was very grumpy, to borrow a phrase, about it, and I was ashamed of Apple for such poor internet behavior. Remember, this was not really a true update, which is almost always a good thing, especially with all the security vulnerabilities that Safari seems to be riddled with these days, but rather the people receiving this offer did not have Safari for Windows at all in the first place. I thought maybe I could help the cause of the righteous by posting an explanation of how to make this stupid update go away so you don't have to keep hitting ignore on Windows. The next time the Apple software update comes up, Select Safari or any update you want to ignore, and then in the menu bar, click on Tools and then pull down to ignore selected updates. From now on, you will not be bugged about Safari, but you'll still get updates to other Apple products that you intentionally loaded on your system. Note in the menu that if you ever want an update back, you can restore them in this with the same Tools menu. There, I've done my public service announcement. Oh, I guess I should mention you can ignore updates in on the Mac, too. Jane from Perth, Australia, sent in a marvelous review of the time capsule and how it solved a real problem for her. Let's sit back and enjoy.
Hi, Alison. This is Jane from Perth in Western Australia. Love your podcast. Great content and so varied. I mean, one minute it's the expected Mac-related material, then it's car waxing. But that's what I like to hear, because yes, I have to admit to this. I too am an enthusiastic washer and polisher of cars. Always have been. But that's enough of that. Anyway, I thought I'd let you know my thoughts on my recent purchase of the new Apple Time Capsule. So a little bit of background first. Our computer setup consists of an iMac G5 in the family room, my MacBook Pro Core Duo in the study, where there is also a rarely used PC running Windows XP. Also in the study is a Canon printer and the current wireless router, which is a D-Link DSL G604T. This setup has served me quite well for 2 years. However, sharing photos between iPhoto had always been a bit of hit and miss. Sometimes the iMac would see shared photos, but it all seemed to depend on which way the wind was blowing or how many rubber chickens I could swing around at one time. It was so frustrating. There I was, running back and forth between the two rooms, trying to copy photos from one iPhoto to another, and iPhoto just seemed to want to deny their existence. Then Leopard came along, and I thought, aha, this will solve it with the new screen-sharing feature. And yes, that did help, sometimes. But yet again, it was flaky. One minute, the iMac was visible, and I could access my husband's account on the iMac. The next, it would refuse to appear. And no, it wasn't my husband blocking me from accessing his machine. I came to the conclusion that the D-Link router just wasn't playing nicely with the Apple gear. Sometimes they were all best of friends. Then D-Link would grab its toys and decide it didn't want to play anymore. What is needed, I thought, is some improved integration. An Airport Extreme base station would probably help. And then Steve Jobs announced Time Capsule. Yep, that sounds like a neat idea, I said to myself, especially as I have external hard drives hanging off the two Macs. In fact, I have two attached to the MacBook Pro, one to accommodate my iTunes library as well as for backups. This was fine when the laptop was plugged into everything on my desk, but as soon as I took it outside, I could no longer listen to podcasts or music, and the endless plugging and unplugging of drives was starting to become a real hassle. So I bided my time and listened to various reviews on Time Capsule, and when most of the comments seemed positive, I decided to take the plunge and go for the 500GB Time Capsule. As nice as it would have been to have had the terabyte size, I couldn't justify the extra $270, which is about $250 on the bigger disk size. No doubt I'll regret that one day as it starts to fill up, but now it's just fine. I ordered it at the online store, the first time I've actually used Apple's online service. I usually buy from the local Apple reseller, but they didn't have any in stock and said it would be 2 week wait for their new stock to arrive. 2 weeks! I couldn't wait that long for my new toy. So, on Monday night, I placed my order, and 36 hours later, I had my shiny new Time Capsule. I was very impressed with the delivery time, seeing as how it had to be delivered clear across the Australian continent from Sydney on the east coast to Perth on the west coast, a not inconsiderable 2,000 miles. Now, as my D-Link 604T was a combined router and modem, I also had to buy a standalone modem. So yet more cables and another PowerPoint required. Sheesh, like there isn't enough tangles of spaghetti behind the desk already. So I ran out to another local tech supplier and picked up a Netgear DM111P. Well, it's white, so that must mean it works well with Apple stuff, yes? So now it was time for the installation and setup. I took a deep breath and started reading the manuals for the Netgear modem and then the time capsule. Well, I thought I must be missing something here because it all seemed far too simple. So I just went ahead with plugging things in, entered a few details where appropriate, and bingo! It all, well, it just worked, as someone else once said. I had internet access via Ethernet to the iMac and PC, and wirelessly to my MacBook Pro. Let's see how the Macs and PC talk to each other then. Yep, there they are in the sidebar, good. Tried to access my husband's account. Yep, no problem. Wow, that was quick, straight into all his folders. No spinning cogwheel waiting to connect. As usual, the PC can't see the Macs, but I really don't care anymore, as the PC only gets used very rarely. And then it's because I need to remind myself how to do something in Windows to help out a family member. And yes, I do have Windows via Parallels on my MacBook Pro, so I'm not quite sure why I'm still using the PC box. Oh well, maybe old habits just die hard. Anyway, back to Time Capsule. Screen sharing works fine. Great. Okay, now the real test. I fire up iPhoto on both machines and see what can be seen on the other's iPhoto, or not, as is usually the case. Well, that's amazing. It actually works instantly. I can see both sets of iPhoto's shared albums on the other Mac, if you get what I mean. Well, it means I can now copy photos from one Mac to the other without all the room hopping that previously went on. Brilliant. This is how things are meant to be in a Mac world. I just never got to experience it using the D-Link router. Well, I was mighty pleased with the new network setup, and then I found a bonus use for Time Capsule's hard drive. I was listening to another podcast. Yes, I'm sorry, Alison, but I listen to other podcasts as well as yours. Anyway, I heard that you could put your iTunes library onto Time Capsule's hard drive and access it wirelessly from other Macs. How fab would that be, I thought. So a few hours later, my iTunes library was copied over to Time Capsule, and yes, it works great, even over my G network. So now I can listen to my music and podcasts wherever I am around my house, inside or out. Wonderful. Oh, and yes, the first backup to Time Capsule takes many hours. So I did each Mac's first backup overnight, so never noticed the long drawn-out copying of files. All in all, I'm a very happy bunny now that I have Time Capsule. Thanks again for a great podcast and keep up the good work. P.S. Did I mention, this is the very first time I've recorded audio stuff, so please forgive the stuttering and stumbles throughout the recording. I even had to buy a USB Logitech headphones and mic just for this message, and learn how to use GarageBand. Geez, I hope it was worth it.
Jane, I can't believe this is your first recording. Your audio quality is marvelous and your delivery is just beautiful. I'm so glad you took the time and energy to send in this review. I've been itching to buy a time capsule, but I just haven't been able to figure out why I couldn't live without it. You've pushed me a little bit closer. I keep thinking I might need one. I do have some gift certificates from some listeners to the show to Amazon, so maybe. Well, anyway, anytime you feel compelled to send in another review, I think we'd all be delighted to hear it. Well, this next thing is a little tiny tip that just makes me happy. You know that here on the No Silicast, we always have to start with a problem to be solved, right? Well, one problem I have is that the Mac doesn't automatically display a nice month-at-a-glance calendar. I know there's a dashboard widget, and that does kind of help, but it does it with so much fanfare. Dim the screen, wait until every widget has made its internet connection, which can take a while if you don't access your widgets constantly. Well, most Mac users rarely dig under the hood and play with the command line, but it turns out here's a case where it's really useful. If you open the Terminal application, which is sitting in your Utilities folder, in just three characters you can get a month-at-a-glance calendar. You simply type in Cal, and you have this month's calendar. Well, what if you want to see the whole year? You can't do that with any other built-in services on the Mac that I know of. To get the whole year, simply type Cal 2008, and you get all of 2008. Want last year? Cal 2007, and you're in business. Oh, there's a space between those two, Cal space 2007, by the way. What if you want a specific month in a specific year? It's still easy. Let's say we want March of 2006. Simply type Cal 03 2006, and instantly you've got the calendar on screen. I bet you never knew that the terminal could be such a useful little lookup tool. I use it all the time for this. Listener Margaret was in the market for a point-and-shoot digital camera, and she didn't want to spend a lot of money. She'd had good luck with Kodak over the years, so she researched the Kodak EasyShare Z812IS. They could use some help in their naming, I'm thinking. But anyway, that's the camera she took a look at. And according to the reviews over at dpreview.com, which is a fantastic site, by the way, for looking at digital cameras, they said it was pretty darn good for the money. Well, before I get too far into Margaret's review, I should tell you that this camera is on sale at Amazon for $208. It's a small point-and-shoot, like I said, but it's not one of those teeny compact models that you throw in your purse. Instead, it's got more of a traditional camera shape with a substantial grip on the right-hand side, and it sports a 12x optical zoom. $208! I was a little skeptical, but I went off and read the reviews that she read, and man, DP Review really, really liked it. So I put a link in the show notes to one of the beautiful photos Margaret took with the Z812IS. It's a dopey name, I know, but I can't help it. That's what they named it. Anyway, you can see for yourself what beautiful shots this camera can take. I wanted to give you some notes that Margaret sent me about the camera. Here's what she said. The learning curve on this camera is low. I did have a head start because I've owned EasyShares before. Still, it's an easy camera to learn. My dad is going to buy the same camera. You can choose to use the auto features or the manual P, A, S, and M modes. I'm going to have to read up on that because aperture, ISO, and compensation settings is all Greek to me. I listened to your latest podcast and Bart lost me on how to take 7 photos to make 1 photo. Basically, if I can get half as good as your photography, then I'll be happy. Other features on the camera include HD video, panoramic stitching. This feature is very nice. Well, like I said, I've been pushing some of these things off for quite a while, and this was something she wrote to me quite a while back because she was referring to back when we were talking about the HDR photography. I do really appreciate Margaret's review of the Kodak EasyShare camera because while it doesn't meet my requirements, personally, I often get people asking, okay, what's an easy camera to get that will still give me good pictures? Now I'm recommending to those who don't mind a little bit of bulk and don't want to deal with the whole SLR thing, though, changing lenses and all that, but still want good quality and don't want to spend a lot of money, to check out the Z812IS, because I think it might just fit the bill. And her pictures are coming out really nice. Well, kids, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie. How is your broadband today, Bart?
Right now, it's still absolutely terribly rubbish, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But I'm not sure if it's a train, but I hope it isn't.
What's the plan?
I've given up on the idea of any sort of wireless broadband whatsoever, and I want a physical wire coming to my house. None of this going through the air malarkey. So I've decided on getting DSL. I have found a provider of DSL that offers a reasonable package at a reasonable price, so I'll be getting 3 megs down, which is a meg less than I theoretically get from ICE, but don't. And only 384K up, which is a big hit, because I used to be on theoretically 2 megs, but of course in reality, almost nothing. So maybe it isn't going to be a big hit. But the big thing is there's no cap. So I have unlimited bandwidth, which is the reason I went for ICE in the first place. And it's €48 per month.
Now, by cap, you mean decent. Maximum you can transmit within a month?
Exactly.
Okay.
Most Irish ISPs cap it at, some of them are pathetic, at like 10 gigabytes a month, which I'll go careering clean through just with podcasts alone, I think.
Yeah, definitely. You know, people in the U.S. complain, and it all started with Walter Mossberg at the All Things Digital Conference. He interviewed the guy that caused the broadband to be so good in South Korea, and he found out that South Korean broadband is just spectacular for pennies. Mm. And the rumor has gone around ever since then that everybody on Earth has better broadband than the United States. And yet I keep talking to people who are having these terrible problems with, you know, really high prices and low bandwidth and that sort of thing. And I think it's just the rumor got out of control that maybe there's 3 or 4 countries that are way, way, way better. But I don't think across the board it's better than the U.S. In general.
I can't really comment on the U.S., but certainly within Europe, everyone's better than Ireland. I think we came second last in a recent survey. So there's one other country, but I don't remember its name, and it's probably small.
So maybe I'm doing the same thing that he did with South Korea. I'm doing the same thing with Ireland and saying all other countries are like Ireland.
Yeah, oh, in Ireland, they're very, very much the exception. And even if you cross the border into Northern Ireland, it's a whole different story. They have like 16 meg DSL for like pittance.
Oh, really?
And from the same companies. It's like the iPhone down here. I mean, O2 sell the iPhone in the UK for, you know, way more reasonable rates than they sell it here in Ireland. And BT sell broadband in the UK for way more reasonable rates than they sell it here in Ireland. And it's technically the same company.
Wow. That's interesting.
Well, they do call it the rip-off republic.
So now, what's the company you're going to go with next?
I'm going to go with Irish Broadband, but it comes with a price. So it's the 48 quid go to Irish Broadband, which is fine. But in order to get DSL, one needs a phone line, because that's how DSL works.
Ah.
And in Ireland, we had an insanely stupid thing our government did a long time ago. They decided on a whim they would privatize telecommunications, and they didn't split off the infrastructure from the actual company, the semi-state company that ran it. Instead, they privatized the whole lot, and they basically gave one company control of the infrastructure and then said, okay, now open up to competition. But one company controls the infrastructure. I know, it's a really stupid idea.
So there's price fixing then?
Oh, there's also gross incompetence. The reason I went with ICE in the first place, because I never, ever, ever wanted to have to deal with Aircom again for as long as I lived. But ICE are now so insanely bad that I've decided that Aircom are tolerable. Although they frayed my nerves this week. So there's a phone in the house. When I pick up the phone, I get a dial tone. There's a special number you can ring that tells you your phone number, and I can ring that and it works and it tells me what my phone number is. So I figure, okay, we're on the right road here. So I ring up Aircom and say, hello, I'd like to, you know, start paying you for using this phone, please. And they said, sure, that'll be €25. And then they went, please hold for a moment, like push some buttons. Long silence, no hold music even, long silence, and they come back and they say, actually, that phone hasn't been activated since 2002, so we're going to set this up as a fresh installation.
Oh no, with a price?
Oh, with a price. I get to spend an extra €100 for no earthly reason whatsoever.
Oh no.
And they wouldn't even put me onto a manager.
And you explained that you have a dial tone?
Oh, yeah, he said, oh, well, that doesn't mean anything. I said, and I can ring and get my number. And he went, oh, well, that doesn't mean anything. Policy, we have to do this. It's been so long, we have to do this. And it's like, so what number will I have on this magical new connection? And he called out exactly the same number I have now. So they're just profiteering. And he wouldn't put me onto a manager. He said, no, we don't have, we're not allowed to put people onto managers. Here's a separate number you can call for complaints. And I was like, no, the complaints department have no power to fix this. Your manager has the power to fix this. I want to talk to your manager. No, I'm sorry, sir, can't do that. Would you like broadband? I said, no, not from you. So I got quite grumpy with them. I said, okay, for the moment, let's play along with this. So, because I have no choice. They have a monopoly. They own all the infrastructure. So I reluctantly gave him my bank details and set up a direct debit. And I said, so how long will this take if it's not a new line? He said, oh, 24 hours. And if it is, 28 days. So I'm now going, the 24 hours will be up this evening. So I'm going to pick up the phone and ring a number. And if the phone rings, I'm going to get back onto Aircom. And I'm going to not give up until I get them to not charge me that €100 that they don't need to send an engineer for, because it is almost certainly going to just work.
You know, I learned a technique.
But I rang the complaint line.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I rang the complaint line. It's a completely separate number. Mm-hmm. It is a 1-800 number, so it's free phone at least. I rang the number, and I got a message. Hello, our opening hours are from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday.
There are no complaints on weekends.
But I can't complain. Yeah, exactly. Ah, it's an infuriating company. I've had so many run-ins with them over the years for lots of different things. They're an incompetent ISP. They're an incompetent broadband provider. They're an incompetent telecommunications company. They're just incompetent in every way, shape, size, or form. They tell people that they give them security by giving them WEP, and they tell people to use WEP, generate the WEP key based on the serial number of the little unit, and the SSID is also generated from the serial number of the little unit. And there are people who have found a very, very simple algorithm. It's a couple of lines of C code which turns an SSID into a password.
I'm pretty sure I could figure that out.
Yeah, it's trivially simple. I have the code somewhere. Because I did a whole big expose about it on my blog, a big series, and it got picked up in the media. And they send out a letter to everyone advising them to change their password, but no one seems to know how to do that. And the reality is, if you drive around any Irish city or town, you will see loads and loads of Aircom wireless base stations, and if you just run the little program against them, you have free internet access wherever you go.
Oh, well, that's nice. It's a feature. It's sharing. Hey, I've got an idea for you. When you call these guys back, when you do get them on the phone and you're trying to get the manager, I took a class where this guy talked about how to get what you want when you're in one of those frustrating, ridiculous situations where it's absurd. So the natural instinct is to start getting agitated and upset. And if your objective is to yell at this person, you can go with that strategy. But if you actually want them to do what you want them to do, you might consider another path. And one of the techniques I developed after taking this class was make them stay on the phone until you win. You don't have to make any sense. You don't have to do anything particularly clever. Just don't let them off the phone. I did this once with the Comedy and Magic Club. They had I had a gift certificate to the place, and I went down there and I said, okay, I want to use this gift certificate to see Jay Leno. And they said, oh, well, no, you can't use it on Jay Leno because he takes in all the money from the box office. And I said, well, that's fine because you've had my $100 for like 4 months. So take it out of your pocket and put it into his pocket. And they would not do it. And so I ended up calling a manager. And all I did, I am convinced, I kept that guy on the phone so long, I'm convinced he took money out of his own pocket to get me off the phone.
He was probably looking at his watch going, I've just missed my favorite TV show, my second favorite TV show. I should have been off work 2 hours ago.
Oh, exactly. I did it once with Verizon, too, where I had a guy helping me and he said he couldn't help me. So I said, get your manager on the phone, but can you stay on the phone, too, so we can work it together? So now I know I'm costing him a total fortune because they had two people tied up. I kept them on the phone for an hour and 15 minutes and it was only for like $16. But I was so irritated that they kept doing this kind of thing to me that I just decided to waste like $400 of their money. And I kept pointing that out to him, saying, Verizon doesn't want you to do this. Verizon does not want both of you on the phone this long for $16. Give me the $16. I won.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes no sense at all.
You do have to go into it with a sporting attitude, though. If you get angry, you're never going to win.
No, that's true. That's true. No, at this stage, if I actually manage to get DSL, once the physical phone line is here, the other reason I know the line is working is because I rang up Irish Broadband and they did a line test and it passed.
Oh, interesting.
Not only did it passed well. I can have up to 10 megabits per second DSL.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. I can't wait until you have good broadband.
I can't afford that much. But yeah, the line can cope with that, but I can't. My wallet can't at the moment, but it's good to know.
Yeah, right. When you come into your fortune, you'll be able to upgrade.
Exactly. No, the other reason I know Ice Broadband, well, that I really, really, really hope Ice Broadband are not going to turn out to be a shower of Muppets, is that, they also do wireless broadband the same as Ice does. And so I put in my address and it said, sorry, not available in your area. I thought, well, that's odd because I know my neighbors have it. So I asked the sales rep and he said, oh, well, no, we don't oversubscribe. So the mast and manute is full for the moment. So we're not signing people up.
That's actually good, right?
That's fantastic. I see the little ice van driving around with new fresh dishes to put on people's roofs all the time. And I have this insane urge to take out a penknife and blow up the tires or something. Because it just keeps getting worse around here. And the thing is oversubscribed as it is. And they keep on signing people up. And it's infuriating.
Well, they're going to lose your money.
Oh, yeah. And the amount of... everyone who asks me about broadband, I tell them how much I hate that company and how... I mean, internet shouldn't be stressful. It should be stress relieving.
It's supposed to be a happy thing.
Sort of Russian roulette when I go home in the evening. Will I be able to download my podcasts or won't I? Will I be able to Skype with Allison or won't I? Who knows?
Yeah.
Potluck.
So how soon can we hope for this to be resolved and you're on real broadband?
Well, if I'm right, then my phone line will be working by this time in about 2 hours. Hmm. If Aircom are right, it could be 28 days. But as soon as my phone is functional, I am getting on to Irish Broadband and signing up. So hopefully within a week or 2 weeks, if all goes well.
Great. And your ICE contract is up?
No, I'm working on that. They have I started procedures with our ombudsman, communications ombudsman. And so ICE have 10 working days that started a week ago last Wednesday to give me a decent service.
Hmm.
And so their time runs out on Wednesday, so I'm going to get Comrade to get me out of the contract.
Oh, cool. Excellent.
That's the plan. Otherwise, I am just going to pay them the €99. Actually, no. Otherwise, I'm going to not pay them the €99 and let them send a debt collection company after me and let them waste loads of their money to get the €99 out of me to cancel.
Well, let's see. We actually had some software stuff to talk about, too, here, didn't we?
Did we? Yes, we did.
Oh, but it's always more fun to slag these guys, right?
It is, certainly. To be honest with you, I mean, we sort of end up talking about what I spend my time doing for the week. And really, this week I've spent most of my time chasing after ISPs. And that's been the case a lot of late. The other thing I guess people notice I've been spending a lot of my time on is photography, because we talk about that a lot. And I didn't want to talk about photography last week, so we did some software last week. So this is actually stuff from the week before last, if that makes any sense. But I've been doing a lot of sort of playing around with the GIMP and doing sort of more cool and more powerful stuff that you certainly can't do with iPhoto. And you've been playing around with Photoshop Elements and seeing how easy or hard it is to replicate the same techniques between the two. And I guess in one case, it works out a lot easier for me with the GIMP, and in another case, it works out a lot easier for you with Photoshop Elements.
Right.
So sort of...
To bring people up to speed in case they don't know, the GIMP is the open source Photoshop equivalent, and so it's free. And Photoshop Elements, in this case, I'm working with Photoshop Elements 6, but I haven't read any manuals, any books, or done any effort whatsoever to find out what's been improved in the software.
Well, the other thing to mention, of course, is that the GIMP is cross-platform as well as being free and open source. So right, Linux, right. Windows, Mac. And don't Adobe release all their software across the three as well?
I don't think it's available on Linux that I know of, and they've been really late on the Mac. They finally came out with 6 on the Mac just recently, like weeks ago.
Okay, so Windows people can play along, though, with the Photoshop Elements.
Definitely, definitely. So I wanted to talk about the one that
we're pretty broad this week.
yeah, we're not an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias this week, right?
Yeah, no Macintosh bias at all.
There you go. So I wanted to start with the one that worked well for me, just so if we run out of time, it'll look like you just didn't do it right. But the first one you were doing was these partial black and white photographs. So explain what those look like.
Okay, well, if you can imagine that you have a photograph of something, and then you turn it into black and white and then selectively make bits of it color again. So one that worked particularly well is I have a photograph of sort of the outside of a church with stained glass windows. And the brickwork is fantastic, but because it was floodlit with a horrible sodium lamp, it looked ghastly. It had this horrible orange glow. But the stained glass window, which was lit from a nice white light through it, looked fantastic. So I converted the whole thing to black and white and then basically turned the windows back into color. And so the brickwork looks stunning in black and white. And I could really ramp up the contrast on it, and so the brickwork just looks really rich. And then the color looks really colorful. So I thought that worked well.
Yeah, if you look at Bart's blog, he's got the photograph up, and it's just spectacular. It's a really, really cool-looking photograph. I love it with the partial black and white. It really is very, very dramatic. It's a nice shot. Well, I decided to try to do that on Photoshop Elements. I think we took one of your photos. I don't know if it was another church, but it had a lot of blue sky and then a ton of trees around the edges, and then the church or castle kind of down below. Was it a church?
No, it was a folly, which is a very Irish thing. During the famine, Irish people were dying in their thousands or millions even. And some of the not-so-nasty landlords decided to try help out. And they didn't want to give away money, so they basically made up work that wasn't really there and paid the Irish people to do it. So they built these structures that have no function called follies.
Are you kidding?
So this is Connolly's Folly. So it's a folly near us. Yeah. There's a horse buried under it. Which is it's the excuse for its building.
Wow. I've never
huge.
Heard of that. How interesting.
There's also roads that go nowhere, and they just stop. Because they were just literally built. They're famine relief roads, they're called. But you have follies and relief roads all over the place, and it's literally the better of the English landlords finding an excuse to not, you know, to pay their tenants so they wouldn't starve. So it's completely pointless work, but it's not giving them free money.
Why didn't they build something they needed?
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty of actual useful work done as well, but when there was nothing useful to be done, they would make up these bizarre things. Lots of towers. Like, there's a lighthouse in the middle of Ireland, 50 miles from the sea, and all sorts of these bizarre and weird things. So, yeah. Follies.
How interesting.
But
well,
Connolly's Folly is pretty cool. So you have three massive arches underneath, and then two arches above that, and then a giant obelisk sticking out of the top of all that. I mean, it's pretty impressive. And then it's surrounded on all sides by trees. So I have a shot of it with, you know, the folly and the trees, and then behind it, this really cool blue sky. So I thought it'd be a cool screensaver or desktop to sort of have just the blue of the sky in color and the rest in black and white so that the blue would be really accentuated. And so it took me hours because I had to manually... The way it works with the GIMP is you basically set up a mask and then you color in. So you can flood fill a lot, but you have to sort of manually colour in around all the leaves. And it took me hours, and it was, I gave myself RSI, actually, as it happens. Only a mild case. So then you had a go with Photoshop Elements.
Yeah, and I've been, I had just seen a Photoshop Elements podcast, which unfortunately has pod faded, but they showed the new magic wand selection brush. So I literally clicked on the sky, and it collected about 90% of the sky immediately. And I set the tolerance enough that it would pick up the white clouds and everything, because there was a lot of contrast.
Yeah, this was a very ununiform sky. It was that wispy white cloud. So there was every shade of white along with the blue. I mean, very ununiform.
Yeah, well, so I was able to select a lot of it, and then if I clicked on some of the white wispy stuff, it was additive, so it would pick up all of the white wispy stuff wherever it found it in the sky, and then I did a copy and a paste, which made it a separate layer, and then I turned off the layer below it so I could see what I picked up that I didn't mean to. So, for example, there was some of the pieces of the towers were picked up, and I didn't mean to pick those up, so I just erased them from that layer. I set up a timer, and it would be a really accurate timer, except my son picked up my watch and thought, boy, I wonder why she's got that running. She must not mean to be doing that. And she said, stop. And so I looked down at the watch when I was done. I was all excited. But Lindsay swears she remembers what time I started. She said it took me about 12 minutes to do the black and white.
Okay. Well, that's a hell of a lot less than it took me. Definitely.
So that was the success on the one side. But the second one was a complete and utter failure on my part, I'm afraid.
Yeah, the second one's cool, though. This, technically, I have yet to come across an actual use for this technique, other than it's cool. that's really the technique. But basically, it allows you to fake models. So you take a real picture of a real thing, and it makes it look like you took a picture of a model. And that's really all it does.
I remember the first time I saw one of these, it was some people playing tennis on a tennis court, and it looked like it was a little tiny fake model, like with little tiny cardboard people and that sort of thing. And then I found out it was a real photograph. And I think they call this tilt shift photography.
Yes, but that's sort of because of how it used to be done initially. If you remember really, really, really old cameras, the lens was out the front, and you had the sort of an accordion thing going back to where the film is.
Right.
And you could tilt that front plate with little adjuster screws. And you could shift it left and right. And so basically you take your photograph with the lens off axis from where it should be, and that would give you this funny effect, which is why it's called tilt shift, because you tilt the lens and shift it off axis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's tilt shift. But you can simulate the effect using an image editing tool, and I found loads of tutorials online for doing it with Photoshop. I found one tutorial online for doing it with the GIMP, but with an old version of the GIMP, and they have rearranged some of the menus in the GIMP. So the old instructions, although I understood them, they weren't technically correct anymore. So it said, go to this menu and then click this, but that menu didn't exist anymore, that kind of thing. And I also found that the instructions for the GIMP that I had found weren't quite as good as some of the Photoshop ones. They left out some of the steps that make the effect nicer. So I did my own and stuck them up in the blog, and you very kindly provided me with a photograph, because for the effect to work, you really need a photograph that's taken from on high and that's very brightly lit with, you know, something small down below. And so when you were in Italy, you took this fabulous shot of sort of a square in front of a beautiful church with lots of little people, and little people always work really well on these shots.
It's called the Campo in Siena. It's kind of the town square in front of the church.
It's beautiful. Lots of nice buildings and stuff behind it. And you can see these little cafes on the terrace with the little awnings outside it and people all over the place. So it looked lovely. But it also had lots of hills and sky and stuff. So I cropped it first to get rid of all of that, because that will really ruin the effect. And so basically what you end up doing is you end up very selectively blurring it so that it looks like the depth of field is tiny, which makes it seem as if it's something small close up instead of something big far away, if you get what I mean. Then you also want to increase the sharpness if you can. So an unsharp mask is generally a good way to go. And then you ram up the color saturation so that it looks quite artificial. Tweak the contrast a bit, and then you're done, in theory.
Now, you put up great instructions on this, very, very detailed on how to do it in the GIMP on your blog, which, of course, we will have a link to.
It involves some pretty hefty editing, really, because it involves masking. It involves turning a selection into a mask, and the way it works is that it partially selects some bits so that the blurring is sort of applied gradually. So you use a blend, and then you blur it based on the blend, so that you get strong blurring at the top, then weak blurring to no blurring, to weak blurring back to strong blurring, which gives that fake you know, shallow depth of field. Then you also need to play with curves and stuff. So, you know, pretty advanced editing in a way, which I didn't think Photoshop Elements would be up to. And you don't think it was?
Well, so I started out by trying to use Photoshop Elements to do it. And the first thing I did was try to find Unsharp Mask, which for some reason Photoshop or Adobe decided to move it over to Enhance instead of having it under Filters where it's been since day one. Well, okay, I found
it in the game.
Oh, it is? It's under Enhance?
No, it's under Filters. Yeah. Actually, no, it's under both. It's under Filters and then Enhance.
Well, okay, that makes sense. I did notice the defaults were a little different on Photoshop Elements, but I set them the same as yours, and I was able to make a new layer, and it seemed like it was a little easier than the way you said to do it, and maybe this works on the GIMP too, is you can just take a layer and drag it onto the layer icon, and it makes a second one, it makes a duplicate of it, and I thought, okay, well, this is going to be pretty good, and then Photoshop Elements crashed, and I got to start over, and... So then I got through to the point where I was supposed to create the layer mask, and I've never really understood layer masks, and was really trying to figure this out, and for the life of me, I couldn't find it in the menus, so I used my favorite Borg resource of the Borg mind. I tweeted it, and asked, you know, I wish I knew how to do layer masks in Photoshop Elements, and I also said, Bart says I have to know how to do it by 10 a.m. on Saturday. And Sean Carruthers sent back a link immediately to graphicsoft.about.com where they explained how to fake layer mask because it indeed is not in Photoshop Elements.
Yeah, that's a pretty poor start. because the layer master is one thing, but then the other thing is you need to have the blending tool and the ability to be able to mask based on a blend instead of a simple selection.
Yeah.
So I think you're heading into big trouble there.
Well, I think I fooled around with a little bit more, and I think there actually is a way to do the blended layer mask thing, or the blended thing. But one of the things I'd really like to do when you get grown-up broadband is to do screen sharing with you where you can show me how to do it, because I did find some blending things I could do.
Okay, well, sure. I look forward to that. It'd be a bit of fun. Yeah, so I think that's sort of it. Isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think overall GIMP is, like we said, it's closer to Photoshop, I think, than Photoshop Elements is, that it's got a lot more capability than Photoshop Elements actually has towards, you know, being like Photoshop.
Yeah, it has all the power of Photoshop, I think, and it even has plugins for writing your own scripts and stuff that plug in, but its GUI is very Linuxy, and I don't mean that in a good way. It's a certain feature of free software that the guys who write it tend to be fantastic programmers who write really good software, but they seem to look at GUIs as being sort of an afterthought that you tack on at the end to make your program look pretty. And GIMP suffers from that to some extent. It's not as obvious to use as Photoshop.
You don't like the GIMP shop, though, which is supposed to make it a little bit more GUI-ish, isn't it? Makes it more like Photoshop?
Well, no, it just rearranges all the menus so that they match the way Photoshop has its menus organized.
But since I've been
using the GIMP for years, yeah, it doesn't change the menus. It just rearranges them all so that they're in the order you would expect to find them in if you're a Photoshop user.
Okay.
And I think it also maps the key shortcuts so that they match to Photoshop. So if you take your Photoshop knowledge to the GIMP, you know, you'll be, you know, subconsciously expecting stuff in some menus and subconsciously expecting to use certain keyboard shortcuts and stuff, and they will work in the GIMP. But for someone like me who's been using the GIMP for years, decades possibly even, for me to move to the GIMP shop would be, I'd just do my head in, because everything would have moved.
Yeah, I can see that. That would be a penalty. But I live and breathe on the keystroke, so I when I've installed the GIMP, I do put the GIMP shop on, so I like that. So.
Well, yeah, because you're a Photoshop user, so for you, the GIMP shop is definitely the best way to make the GIMP tolerable.
Well, that's good to know. All right, well, it looks like we have covered everything for this week, and you're going to be around next week for another show, I hope?
We may have to record a little early next week, or is it the week after? At some stage, I'm going home to my parents for half a week, but I don't remember exactly when. But we'll organize something around it. By the way, how long are we doing on time? Have we gone over yet?
We're at 26 minutes.
For 26 minutes, that's all right. I got a Twitter, my Twitter that we were about to start recording, and I just got a Twitter from at Indie Radio Chat saying, at BB Shots, please go long, big smiley.
So, well, that's good.
There we go, we went long.
And I also did my, I did a bonus episode this week because we seem to keep going long, and then I've got all this other stuff I don't get a chance to talk about. So everybody got a bonus show, and I hope they enjoyed that too.
Yeah, and next week we'll try to get back to software, I think.
Sounds good.
Unless we've confused people so much that we're going to spend the whole time answering questions.
Well, there's always that. All right, Bart, well, we'll talk to you soon. Good luck with your broadband.
Cheers, and until next time, happy computing.
Well, after we recorded this segment, I got an email from Rob. I had Twittered about the fact that there was no Elements layer masking, and he sent me an email explaining that there is a free set of tools someone has written to give Elements layer masking. The link to cavesofice.org is in the show notes, and I've already downloaded it, but I haven't had a chance to experiment with it. I've really got to get in there and see how well that works and see whether Photoshop Elements can actually keep up with the GIMP. Probably not, but it'll be fun to try. Well, that's going to wind things up for this week. I hope you had fun, because I sure did. Let's do this again next week, shall we? Until then, keep those letters coming to allison@podfeet.com, or if you're energetic and want to find out how hard it is to make a recording, send one in to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.